fire at a Mexican holding facility for migrants turns deadly. The tragedy leads to anger and questions about how this could happen.
They didn't open the door to the holding rooms where these men were being held.
Also, Europe debates whether nuclear is a renewable energy source. We meet Ukraine's female force of drone operators, and stolen relics are returned to Cambodia.
Oh! I'm never making such a huge sculpture.
That one of the Hindu elephant god Ganesh. I'm Marco Werman, and ask a beer expert about the world's best. Many point to the stuff brewed by Trappist monks.
People were really obsessed about the Trappist beers, like there was some kind of Holy Grail.
But the future of the Holy Grail may be in question. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for being with us. We start today with the grim news from Juarez, Mexico, on the U.S. border with El Paso. A deadly fire there last night ripped through a Mexican government facility that was holding immigrants. The blaze took the lives of at least 39 people, injuring almost as many. It's one of the deadliest incidents of its kind. El Paso Times reporter Lauren Villagran spent the morning in Juarez and shared with us what she saw there.
The fire took place inside an immigration facility that's right at the foot of the international bridge between El Paso and Juarez. I spoke to the spouse of one of the men who survived but was injured by smoke inhalation, who said that yesterday afternoon, Mexican immigration authorities were rounding up anybody who looked like a migrant and put the men in this holding facility.
I can't imagine what the mood is like in the neighborhood where the fire took place. What were you seeing and feeling as you walked through there today?
Yeah, well, it's kind of smack in the middle of some very heavy border infrastructure, the international bridge. The city hall of Juarez is right next door, and it's packed with commuter traffic, cross-border commuter traffic going all morning. All that you can see right now of the tragedy that took place is the charred outside of the stone immigration building that looks out at the U.S. border fence, the steel border fence right north of the Rio Grande. Of course, you know, the area is filled with media, and it's heavily guarded by Mexican National Guard soldiers.
There were 68 men in the facility. Each of them was either killed or injured. Staff were not, though. What made it possible for the staff to get to safety but not the detainees?
Well, we're still waiting for more official information about exactly what took place. But the woman I spoke with, whose husband was injured, said that her husband was detained for something like 7 hours yesterday. And she was inside the facility when it began to fill with smoke. And her recollection is that National Guards, members of the Mexican National Guard and migration agents began rushing everybody out of the building, the women and children, the administrators, but they didn't open the door to the holding rooms where these men were being held. So it's not clear why. It's not clear why they wouldn't open the door or what the conditions were inside that led them to act that way. But that's what I'm hearing from someone who was there.
Mexico's President Andrés Manuel López Obrador spoke about the fire at a press conference this morning. He said the detainees themselves started the fire as a protest.
Pusieron colchonetas del albergue y les prendieron fuego.
Lauren, what is Mexico's president saying there about this tragedy?
Yeah, he's saying that the migrants themselves took little mattresses that were in what he called a refuge, what others are calling a detention center, and set fire to them. I did speak with a National Guardsman this morning who was not authorized to speak with the press, but who said that it's not exactly a jail cell. It's more like a holding room, and that the migrants still had all of their belongings, including cell phones. So, you know, it's entirely possible that somebody did have a lighter. I don't have any other further official confirmation of exactly what started the fire other than what the Mexican president has said publicly this morning.
Right. Tell us about the migrants who would be at this detention facility. Where do they start their journeys and how would they end up in a detention center in Juarez?
Well, many of them are from Venezuela and have arrived in Juarez, right at the U.S. border. In recent months. You know, tensions have been growing here, Marco, because with the U.S. border largely closed to asylum seekers, except through this digital application called CBP One, folks are waiting for appointments. The app is crashing often, so it's been very difficult for some people and families to get appointments. And people are trying to get by here in Juarez, selling, you know, roses on the street, selling candy, washing windows. At the same time, authorities in the city have been having problems with migrants. They've been saying that, you know, they're causing issues. It's not exactly clear what all of those issues are, but federal migration authorities have been doing these roundups. And so it's not precisely a detention center where they were held. It's literally the foot of a bridge, of an international bridge connecting El Paso and Juarez. And that's where these folks were being held yesterday. The woman I spoke with, Viangli Infante, said she is here legally in Mexico. Her husband is here legally in Mexico and was still detained.
And the woman you spoke with, what did happen to her husband?
She was outside the Hospital de Familia, which is a hospital right in front of this facility. She said her husband is in stable condition now, but had injury from smoke inhalation. So luckily, you know, he survived. And they, in fact, have been in Juarez since December, waiting for an opportunity to cross the U.S. border. They have an appointment through the CBP-1 application for an opportunity to cross the border on Saturday.
You've visited facilities like this one where the fire happened. I mean, typically, what are conditions like?
You know, to be honest, Marco, I did not even know that migrants were being held in this space where normally there are immigration officials that will approve visas. It's a bureaucratic type of facility that apparently has some rooms in the back where they've been holding people. I think they were clearly inadequate to be holding migrants in a detained setting because, again, migration authorities here have suddenly been rounding up people. The city authorities have been fed up with migrants begging on the street or, you know, selling candy, selling roses. I don't think that they like the image that it provides the city. At the same time, you have many, many migrants here. There are not enough shelter spaces. And so the situation just really has become critical, no more so than last night when this tragedy took place.
And those migrants somehow need to find some money, right? I mean, they need to sell something.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Juarez is an expensive place. You know, people may think, oh, it's Mexico, but it's a dollar economy here. Rent is expensive. It's very hard to find a place to live, even for Mexicans here. So migrants are in a very, very precarious situation. They're also very vulnerable. People know that they're migrants because of the way that they're dressed or their accent, or of course, you know, the fact that they may be sleeping in precarious conditions.
Lauren Villagran is a reporter with the El Paso Times. She joined us from Juarez, Mexico, where a fire at an immigrant facility last night took dozens of lives. Lauren, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Ever since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine last year, athletes from Russia and Belarus have been pretty much banned from international sports competitions. But as the 2024 Paris Olympics come into view, international sports federations are considering whether or not to uphold that ban. Today, the International Olympic Committee weighed in. IOC President Thomas Bach expressed empathy for Ukrainian athletes, then added,
"Sport and the Olympic Games can set an example for a world where everyone respects the same rules and one another. They can open the door to dialogue and peace building in ways that exclusion and division do not."
Bach said the IOC only supports the participation of Russians and Belarusians in international competitions if they meet certain criteria. For one thing, teams from those countries should not be admitted. Individual athletes are okay, but only if they are deemed neutral. Here is Bach's definition.
Athletes who actively support the war cannot compete. Athletes who are contracted to the Russian or Belarusian military or national security agencies cannot compete.
Bach said the international federations who govern each sport will be responsible for deciding if an athlete is neutral. The IOC said staff and coaches working with the athletes would also have to be neutral. People who have been pressuring the IOC to stand up to Russia see today's announcement as a small win. The IOC has not yet ruled on whether Russian and Belarusian athletes will be allowed to compete in the 2024 Summer Olympics or under what circumstances. They declined to say when that would happen. For Cambodia, it's a homecoming that had been anticipated for years. Centuries-old artifacts are now back in country. Many were looted when the Khmer Rouge was in power in the late 1970s. Most of the stolen relics were later linked to disgraced art dealer Douglas Latchford. He was indicted for trafficking artifacts back in 2019 before he died. Reporter Lila Goldstein with Southeast Asia Globe was at the airport in Phnom Penh when the cargo arrived.
It was dark when the nondescript plywood crates were unloaded from the plane. One, much larger than the rest at about 7 feet tall, stood out. Stenciled in big letters at the top was the name Latchford. Bradley J. Gordon, a U.S. attorney representing the Cambodian government, read the stamps and shipping labels.
So this is the shipping company that Latchford used in New York, and then it was on loan in Berlin at this museum, and then he sold it to Jim Clark.
That's Jim Clark, the American billionaire and Netscape founder. The markings traced the journey of a 3-ton 10th century statue of Ganesha, the elephant-headed Hindu deity. It was looted in connection with Douglas Latchford around 2003 from the Bach Temple at Kokur in northern Cambodia. Latchford lent it to Berlin's Museum of Indian Art before he sold it to Clark. The statue likely hasn't been taken out of the box in almost 20 years.
We've done so much research on this piece, so to see it back home and to see it with his name on it. He wasn't clever enough. It came back in the end. The Ganesha is more powerful than Latchford's cleverness.
Part of Latchford's cleverness, as Gordon called it, was using the art world as a cover for his looting. By lending pieces to prestigious museums that didn't ask too many questions about provenance, the pieces had an air of legitimacy. And that made them easier to sell to wealthy people like Jim Clark.
It's not that the art world was corrupted by Douglas Latchford, or art historians are corrupted, or the Met was corrupted. This is the art world.
Ashley Thompson is a professor at SOAS University of London, specializing in Cambodian art history.
There is this line of colonialism up until capitalism. It's not that the art market went wrong in this instance.
There's been a push among scholars and activists to return looted objects to their countries of origin. In the case of Latchford, the Department of Justice sought the forfeiture of pieces from private collectors and a museum. Some relics were returned voluntarily. The next day, at the National Museum of Cambodia, a team of men start prying open the boxes. Buddhist monks in orange robes throw lotus flowers as the crates are opened. But the biggest reveal of the day is the Ganesha statue.
Oh my God! Wow. It's too huge! Oh! I never imagined such a huge sculpture like that. Oh my God, really.
Hab Tuch, Secretary of State of the Ministry of Culture and Fine Arts, is nearly breathless upon seeing the massive sculpture.
This is our ancestors, you see? It's our ancestor, our spirit. Normally, you know, we consider all the sculpture, not only sculpture, not only stone, not only bronze, but our gods.
Rose Saru also works with the ministry. She prays to the statue and offers the deity water, saying that Ganesha is probably thirsty after all those years in the box.
Oh, you know, we never think that we can collect all this back, you know. And now it's true. We can see, we can receive, and we're very happy that he can return back to the country. And we hope that some of the statue will continue coming back to the country.
She's proud of this moment and hopes publicity of these returned statues will make collectors from around the world think about the pieces sitting in their own collections. It's time for them to return home, she says. For The World, I'm Lila Goldstein.
You are with The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. Ukraine's military has long relied on women. Female officers date back to World War I. But one defense job that Ukrainian women had not really undertaken prior to the Russian invasion is operating drones. That changed recently after one man set up a drone pilot school exclusively for women. Dina Temple Raston of the Click Here podcast has our story.
Not long after the war between Russia and Ukraine began, Valery Borovik had this idea. He wanted to start a drone training program just for women.
Because many men go to zero line, go to army. And women can help and want to help for protect of our country.
Borovik is the CEO of Alliance New Energy of Ukraine. And among other things, the company actually manufactures drones.
Прийшла ідея зробити школу. Школу пілотес.
That's from one of the school's promotional videos.
Якомога більше дівчат керувати дронами.
Borovik's drone school opened its doors last summer, and he called it the Female Pilots of Ukraine. The way he saw it, both sides of this conflict are looking for creative ways to beef up their fighting forces. Russia has gone to prisons to recruit convicts and is drafting young men right off the streets. Ukraine, for its part, is counting on its women.
If girl can fly all drone, we can see Russia soldier or tanks near our army.
So the women can add to the war effort by being eyes for the army.
Yes, yes. It's like eyes for us.
Дівчата, значить, поздравляю вас з закінченням школи.
Borovik talks to a small group of his students in a field outside Kyiv. They're all bundled up against the cold in heavy parkas and snow pants and boots, and the wind is howling. Marina Horunja is a mother of two, a translator and a former model, and she's one of the people Borovik recruited for the flight school. In fact, a lot of the women standing in that freezing cold field are from Ukraine's fashion industry. Think of them as Borovik's model pilots. They begin instruction in a place far from the war's front lines.
We are not on the location when the people are just dying, and we are learning in Kyiv, in the capital of Ukraine.
Basic training lasts for about 3 weeks.
But usually it was fun because we had coffee, some cookies, and we had good mental health, you know.
Professional military drone pilots come in and teach them the basics.
Some of us were piloting, and others were using the map.
They start on drone simulators.
We used on the computers, then we had to...
If they do well on that part of the training, the group graduates to the outdoor part of instruction. Professional military drone pilots teach them the basics of controlling the drone, and then they give them a specific location they need to fly to.
To the gas station, for example, just wait, make a couple of pictures.
Harunja, it turns out, is particularly good at interpreting maps to get the drones where they need to go.
For example, if I was checking where the drone goes, so I was standing behind the pilot, and I would tell that, for example, you need to go straight, then up 30 degrees or something like that.
They're also taught how to drop a virtual pin and mark where their drone might have spotted Russian troops or equipment, or even where it might need to quickly land. That information is later sent to Ukrainian forces or police nearby so they can plan a response or recover a fallen drone. Harunja thinks women are particularly well-suited to be great drone pilots, and let's just say she thinks maternal instinct comes into play.
I think every woman must understand that no matter what happens, she's able to protect her kids, her family, if it's necessary, you know.
One of Ukraine's other best-kept secrets, aside from its female drone pilots, is just how much it has MacGyvered plastic off-the-shelf drones to wreak havoc on Russian troops.
Why are Ukraine's cheap, slow drones so successful against Russian targets?
The soldiers work round the clock, repairing, modifying, and arming consumer drones.
Most analysts agree that Ukraine's creative use of these tiny flying machines is one of those underdog bright spots of the war. Though there are some risks. The off-the-shelf consumer drones Ukraine is using are basically a flying bundle of communication systems and software, which makes them more vulnerable to attack than the military-grade drones we usually see on the battlefield. Among other things, Russian forces have been able to use radio transmitters to override the GPS signals controlling the drones the women fly. Consumer drones follow whichever signal is strongest, so the Russians can sometimes hijack them. And then last year, Russian communications intelligence operators started tracking the drones' electromagnetic signatures, and that allowed them to pinpoint the location of Ukrainian drone pilots. Once they found them, the Russians called in mortar fire.
We understand that if they see us, for example, in the middle of the field of some area, you know, anything can happen. So it was actually dangerous.
It became such an issue that Ukraine's Minister of Digital Transformation warned about it on his Twitter page. And Hurunja said now it's part of the drone pilot school curriculum. They never launch from the same place twice. And the Ukrainian drone pilots have started to deploy countermeasures, something they call, appropriately enough, Olga. It's a simple black box that plugs into the drone's USB port and scrambles the signal in a way that makes it harder to hijack or locate it.
Olga can block Russian system and Russian drones, and they cannot find us.
More than a year after the war began, Hurunja says she never for a moment considered leaving Ukraine to wait out the war. And while she's not at the zero line, some of the people she's training with are.
Girls who has learned after me, they are on the east of Ukraine right now. But still, maybe some people don't understand that woman, even the most kind like me, you know, the one who will never do something bad for any insect or something like that, if some invader comes to your country, I believe that many people, they just don't realize how strong women are.
For the world, I'm Dina Temple-Raston.
Dina is the host of the weekly Click Here podcast from Recorded Future News. The story was produced by Sean Powers and Will Jarvis. You can hear the full-length episode for the story by searching Click Here wherever you get your podcasts. More stories from around the globe still ahead for you this hour. You're listening to The World. When the U.S. military began its withdrawal from Vietnam, Vietnamese soldiers and pilots were trained up fast to take their place, like this pilot sent to Mississippi to learn to fly American planes.
I was about 22 or 21. A young man, you know, I don't have any clue about the war.
50 years later, a Vietnamese pilot reflects on his experience ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Millions of French have taken to the streets for the 10th time as they protest the government's plans to raise the retirement age. It isn't just older workers who are angry. College students also support the strike, even though the retirement plan could help them when they're older. Jerry Haddon reports from the university town of Toulouse, where tens of thousands of people demonstrated today.
10 protests over about 10 weeks. College student Jonah Michelier has marched in all of them.
It's amazing. I believe that I can help to make this country a better place.
Michelier is revved up on his way to this latest mass protest in Toulouse's city center. Up till now, he says, he's never done anything political. But President Macron's raising the retirement age from 62 to 64 touched a nerve.
You know, my grandfather, he was a member of the Parti Communiste Français, so he always taught me about these values, to go on strikes, to get what we want.
Michelier's dad is a steel worker. His mom cooks and cleans in a school. He's the embodiment of France's angry working class, and he's the first person I meet earlier in the day. I'm wandering the abandoned campus at the University of Toulouse. The entrances to buildings are barricaded with desks and chairs. When students want to shut down class, this is how it's done. Then this student appears, Michelier, tall, wearing a white baseball cap and a varsity letter jacket, baby-faced. He knocks on a papered-over window of a study hall. A moment later, it opens, and he climbs through. Inside, it looks like some sort of student command center. People are milling around, and there are large signs up calling for revolution and protest. A minute later, Michelier comes back out the window. He wants to talk.
We believe that the retirement age needs to be stopped at 60 for most work and 55 for the hardworking people.
When the government says, but if we do that, there's not enough money to pay for Social Security, what do you think of that?
I believe that it's all a lie, because we all know that Emmanuel Macron has a preference for the ultra-rich, the billionaires, and we believe that it's their part to pay more taxes so that hardworking people can enjoy life and not die.
Just then, another student shouts that it's time for a meeting to plan for today's protest. Michelier rushes off, but I'm able to chat with two other students who are guarding the entry window, Lisa and CJ. They're wary of authorities and outsiders, so they won't give me their last names. I ask them why they're against raising the retirement age.
I think more we give work to elder people, more the younger can't work because there is not as many work as we would like.
I think it's like about 300,000 jobs available right now, and more than at least 3 million people seeking for a job. So there is a mathematical problem, basically.
So the longer an older person works, the less jobs there are for the young. That fear is more real to these two than the threat of France's Social Security running dry one day. At the end of that student meeting, people are getting fired up, pounding on desks as they sing. Then they're streaming out the door to head for the march downtown. That's where I catch up again with Jonah Michelier. He points out that the anger the French are feeling goes way beyond the pension reform that Macron pushed through with an executive order. He says that was just the final straw.
The massive inflation, the salaries question, the equality between men and women.
I asked Michelier whether he remembers the massive yellow vest protests triggered by the global economic meltdown of 2008 and continuing all the way until the pandemic hit.
Of course I do. I remember the yellow vest. I was in high school at that time, and for us, for my friends and I, it was just funny. But now I realize how important that movement was.
That movement was unlike anything France had ever seen. Grassroots, decentralized, and relentless. People were angry with banks, but also about job losses and the soaring cost of living.
It came from down. It was pure anger from the people.
COVID-19 stopped the demonstrations, but not the anger. As Michelier and his classmates join the stream of tens of thousands of protesters downtown, the mood is jubilant.
So we're about to go out on the street. How
exactly.
Are you feeling?
Not stressed at all. And now I forgot my fear. But we believe that. Habite! Macron! Macron! On va recommencer!
On the street, Michelier locks arms with colleagues, ready to lock horns with his government, a government that appears just as unwilling to back down. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon in Toulouse, France.
It is decision time for the European Union whether to include nuclear energy as part of its aggressive new renewable energy policy. France, Poland, and other EU states say yes. In the opposite corner, 11 nations led by Germany, Austria, and Spain say no. Philip Lausberg is an analyst with the European Policy Center in Brussels. Explain for us, first off, Philip, what argument does France and the others have for saying nuclear power should be considered renewable?
Well, they say it's carbon neutral. There's no CO2 emissions involved in the production of nuclear power. And yes, it is also something that is largely independent from foreign suppliers, and it can be used 24/7. So it's not dependent on the sun shining or the wind blowing.
And on the other side of the coin, what arguments do Germany and other countries have for saying nuclear power does not qualify for the renewable portfolio?
Well, the other side, led by Germany, what they are saying is that nuclear is neither sustainable, nor is it safe, and nor is it fast to implement, because it takes years to build nuclear power stations.
I'm wondering your opinion on this. By not classifying nuclear energy as a renewable source of energy, would that in fact push those subsidies to more wind and solar development?
Well, that is quite likely so, considering that subsidies are, you know, a limited resource. If you have to decide where to put the money, that could be the outcome, yes, that solar and wind and other green energy sources are more subsidized.
If we step outside the world of politics, is nuclear energy as renewable and climate-friendly as solar or wind energy?
No, it's not. You have problems with storing used nuclear fuel rods. It's difficult to source. It comes often from countries outside the EU that don't have very high standards when sourcing nuclear materials like uranium. There's always a risk of nuclear accidents, of course, that we have seen in Fukushima and Chernobyl, and we can never exclude this risk 100%, and that, of course, is not sustainable.
But, of course, nuclear has gotten a second look because of zero carbon emissions, correct?
So in terms of carbon emissions, that's correct, yes.
I'm also wondering how the war in Ukraine and cut off energy supplies from Russia have impacted this whole debate over nuclear being renewable or not.
I think it has impacted it a lot, because if you look at the coalition of states that are behind France in favor of nuclear, then we can see that this coalition has grown since the war in Ukraine, because some countries just realized that dependence on Russian hydrocarbons, especially Russian gas, has really left them at the mercy of Russia and high energy prices, whereas nuclear power tends to be quite independent. That is definitely an argument when it comes to energy security.
So, Philip, who has the upper hand in this debate? How do you think it's going to shake out? And will it happen without any slowdown to the ambitious renewable goals?
Well, I think we already see a slowdown because this debate has been going on for a while. And I could imagine that there will be no agreement in the near future. But when it comes to reaching some sort of agreement in the midterm, I believe that this is definitely possible. And I think compromise solution could look something like using nuclear as a transition energy source for green hydrogen.
I've been speaking with Philip Lausberg. He's an analyst with the European Policy Center and joined us from Brussels. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
It was almost exactly 50 years ago when the last U.S. troops left Vietnam. The drawdown had begun years earlier in 1969. With the U.S. public increasingly opposed to the war, President Richard Nixon was under pressure to pull troops out. In a speech to the nation, Nixon said the U.S. military would stay long enough to train up the South Vietnamese Army.
Under the new orders, the primary mission of our troops is to enable the South Vietnamese forces to assume the full responsibility for the security of South Vietnam.
Nixon explained that the sooner the Vietnamese could repair the helicopters and fly the planes, the sooner U.S. troops could leave. Reporter Merck Nguyen spoke recently with one of the Vietnamese pilots who took over from the Americans.
Okay. My name is Lien Nguyen. I was born in 1948. I served in the Vietnamese Air Force. Every young male being drafted to military, and that you are a very good student, maybe delayed at draft. But for me, I'm just average. So sooner or later, they didn't draft me, so I just joined the Air Force.
Barely out of high school, he was sent to the United States to be a pilot. First to Keesler Air Base in Mississippi, then to Randolph in Texas.
6 months English, and after that, you go to flying school. After I will be sent to Keesler again for more advanced training. And when I graduated, I been assigned to transportation plane C-47. I was about 22 or 21. A young man, you know, I don't have any clue about the war. I know it is a war, but for me, fresh out from school, I just report to the assigned leader in Saigon. But last year, we took over the American squadron.
By March of 1972, there were just 70,000 U.S. troops in Vietnam compared to the 500,000 men at its peak. The North seized on the withdrawal, launching the Easter Offensive, known to some Vietnamese as the Summer of Hell.
Oh, man, at that time, the war been high peak, you know, they called it the Summer of Hell in North Central Vietnam. Big battlefield, a lot of people die and a lot of people leave their homeland village.
A It's estimated that some 25,000 civilians were killed and a million were displaced.
We know that the American withdrawal for the supply fuel artery, it'd been limited. Our friend, we fly the helicopter. They don't have enough fuel. They don't have enough weapon. Been cut off.
The war between the North and South continued for 2 more years. The U.S. had promised to keep funding the war, but Congress cut off much of the aid. For Nguyen, who was fighting the communists, the real betrayal was the Nixon administration's olive branch to Red China.
Do I blame America? Early, I do. Because most of Vietnamese military guys say that Americans are foreigners, but they didn't know it. It happened earlier when President Nixon came over to China. We'd be sold out.
In 1975, North Vietnamese tanks rolled into Saigon. The war was marked officially over. And Lan Nguyen? He was able to get a flight out of Saigon, first to Guam and later to a refugee camp in Arkansas.
And we're very angry. But later on, after being here a few years, we have no choice. At the same time, I start to appreciate American have us opportunity to come here, and we have a lot of freedom to do whatever we want to do in our life. I changed my mind. We are very lucky to come over to the United States.
Nguyen eventually settled in Washington State. He married and raised a family and was a truck driver for the next 35 years before retiring. Like many Vietnamese who fled to the U.S., he remains deeply affected by the war and fiercely anti-communist.
Things must be changed. Doesn't mean that I like the communists or not. I don't. I hate communists, but I don't hate Vietnamese people. This is my country and people, you know. I hope someday it will change. It probably won't happen during our lifetime. So I don't feel bitterness about it. I'm in peace with myself, you know. Yeah.
For the world, I'm Merk Nguyen in Linwood, Washington.
Chimay, Rochefort, Westmulla, we're talking Trappist beer, long considered some of the world's best. The Trappist monks that produce the brews are motivated not by profit, but by quality. In Belgium, just 5 such breweries can call themselves Trappist. There used to be 6. Sophie van Raffelum is a beer consultant in East Flanders, Belgium. She says the beer brand Ahol lost its Trappist accreditation in 2021 because there were no monks actually working in the brewery.
One of the criteria wasn't met anymore. The beers have to be brewed within the walls of a monastery of a living community. And of course, you need the monks to have that.
Yeah, you write about beer, Sophie. You're a former beer sommelier. What makes Trappist beer special aside from the fact that they have to be brewed in those monasteries and with the hands of monks involved?
Most special thing about them is that the monks do not work for commercial reasons. And as a consequence of that, efficiency doesn't play a big part in the creating of the beers. So if they have to take more time, or if the ingredients cost more money, who cares? They can't take the time. They want to create great quality beers. As an example, I was able a few years ago to stay with the monks of West Vleteren for about 24 hours.
Is that pretty rare?
Yes. They don't let anyone in, so I considered it a great honor. But it also gave me a unique insight in how they think, how they live, and what's really important to them.
So given the attention to the time of making these Trappist brews and the quality, what does it taste like? How does it compare to, you know, your average beer?
Most Belgian Trappists are quite yeast-driven in character and in flavor. Like, as an example, Westmalle. If you smell the Westmalle beer first, before you take a sip, you will notice the aromas of banana, mostly banana. They've been working with this yeast for years and years and years. The yeast is so powerful in the nose.
Now, there's worry that with fewer men entering monastic life, these Trappist monasteries and their breweries are also going to fall victim. Are they right to be concerned?
Well, I'm quite optimistic about this. And the reason why is it's true, there are less and less Belgians interested in becoming a monk, but there's still interest from all over the world of people who want to be a part of this community, of this order. Although it takes a long time to become a monk, it takes approximately 9 years, so you have to show some dedication.
Beer consultant Sophie von Raffelem was telling us about Belgian Trappist beers and concern she thinks unwarranted that they may become a thing of the past. Sophie, good to have you with us. Thank you.
You're welcome.
In Ukraine, the separation between church and state is laid out in the country's constitution. But right now, the Ukrainian government is cracking down on one branch of Orthodox Christianity, which is raising questions about religious freedom there. President Volodymyr Zelensky's administration views certain Christian leaders as allies of Russia. It's a clash that's coming to a boiling point in the capital, Kyiv, as we hear from The World's Daniel Hoffman.
The Pisherska Lavra, or Monastery of the Caves, was established almost 1,000 years ago. It's an important holy site for millions of Orthodox Christians across Ukraine, as well as Russia. Earlier this year, clergy from the Orthodox Church of Ukraine led Christmas prayer services at the Lavra Cathedral. For many Ukrainians, this was a historic moment. For the first time in many years, the Christmas liturgy was celebrated in the Ukrainian language, not in Russian. Holiday services were also led by clergy from the Orthodox Church of Ukraine, which is fully independent from the church in Moscow.
When we are speaking about the Orthodox Church, for years there is a deep conflict between at least two different communities.
Sergei Chapnin is with the Orthodox Christian Study Center at Fordham University. In addition to the independent Orthodox Church, there's a branch of Ukrainian Orthodox Christianity that's historically connected to the Russian Orthodox Church. The division is now playing out on the grounds of the Kyiv Pisherska Lavra.
All these kind of buildings, all the religious items, including holy relics, are still considered to be in possession of the state.
For many years, the clergy in charge at the Lavra holy site were affiliated with Orthodox leaders in Moscow. But in December, the Ukrainian government decided to take back control.
When Zelensky won the presidential elections in Ukraine, he didn't pay attention to religious policy of Ukrainian government at all until the war started.
Russian Orthodox Church leaders have publicly supported Putin's war effort. President Zelensky has said that Ukraine needs to become, quote, spiritually independent from Moscow. Last year, Ukrainian security services started raiding churches where clergy were suspected of being loyal to the Kremlin.
So Putin weaponized the religious factor, and Zelensky has to reply.
Zelensky's most recent response is the eviction notice. Earlier this month, members of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church were given a deadline of March 29th, tomorrow, to leave the Lavra complex.
We are forced to leave this holy place against our will, by force.
In this video posted online, a Ukrainian Orthodox priest is flanked by dozens of clergymen and seminary students.
We appeal to Ukrainian authorities, to the public, to the international organizations and communities to pay attention to this situation.
This group is among several hundred priests, monks, students and employees, all facing eviction from the Lavra complex in Kyiv. Christina Stuckel is a professor at Louise University in Rome, where she studies religion and politics.
Most members of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church condemn the Russian invasion. They don't support the Russian position, and they feel to all effect as Ukrainian patriots.
Stuckel says in some cases, leaders from that branch of the church have indeed expressed support for Moscow.
Some representatives of that church are openly pro-Russian, and several others are maybe less openly pro-Russian, but they are suspected to support the Russian position in the war.
She says the Ukrainian government is trying to nudge people of faith toward the independent branch of the Orthodox Church in Ukraine. But this eviction order could also end up alienating some patriotic Ukrainians who just happen to be connected with the other branch of the church.
I actually think it's possible that there is a coexistence of the two churches, even on those very same premises, because there already is a dialogue forum and many of them know each other and also have friendly relationships with each other.
Some of the monks at the Kyiv-Pechersk Lavra have said that they're staying put on the holy site and will refuse to leave before Wednesday's deadline. For The World, I'm Daniel Hoffman.
This is a song called The Homeless Wanderer. It was featured in the 2020 Oscar-nominated documentary Time. The person playing the piano, also the composer, is Emohoy Tsege Mariam Gebru, an Ethiopian musician and composer who has died just shy of her century mark. To say that Emohoy Tsege Mariam Gebru lived a rich life undersells her remarkable story. She was born into wealth and privilege in Ethiopia in 1923. At the age of six, she was sent to a Swiss boarding school, something highly unusual for an Ethiopian girl at the time. It was there that she was introduced to classical music after hearing a concert by a blind man. In a BBC documentary, Gebru described how it launched her life in music.
I started at the age of eight, and there was a piano near my room. I was going and just typing the piano. People passed, they said to me, "What are you playing?" I said, "The Storm."
In the 1930s, Emohoy Tsege Mariam Gebru returned to Ethiopia. She was part of society that hung out with the country's elite, even with former emperor Haile Selassie. After Italy's invasion of Ethiopia, Gebru and her family were sent to a prison camp on an Italian island. After World War II, she moved to Cairo to resume her studies of classical music. And then she gave it all up. She spent a decade in self-exile in a remote monastery in Ethiopia, giving up most of her worldly possessions, including her shoes. Eventually, she returned to Addis Ababa and slowly back into her life as a musician, while also remaining a nun. Her waltz-like music became linked to the innovative sounds of Ethio-jazz that came out of Addis Ababa in the 1960s. Gebru recorded more than 150 original compositions and donated the proceeds to charity. She also started a foundation to help provide music lessons for children who couldn't afford them. Gebru spent the last 40 years of her life in Jerusalem, living in a tiny room in an Ethiopian monastery. She was 99. Music of the late Emohoy Tsege Mariam Gebru plays us out today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong, and thanks for listening.